My name is Michael Castro. I'm the director of the series. And on behalf of River Styx and the ownership at Duff's, welcome. We have a real multicultural evening planned featuring the poets Curtis Lyle and Carter Rivard, and the musical ensemble Iris Concepcion and Los Conchos. And we'll begin with Carter, then have the music, and then have Curtis. A little bit about Carter Rivard. He's well known to many of us as a widely published poet whose work draws on his Osage ancestry and heritage. He was born in Oklahoma in 1931. He attended Tulsa University, the Yale Graduate School, where he earned a PhD in medieval literature, Oxford University, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. He has been teaching at Washington University for some 20-plus years. In 1951, he was given his Osage name, and this was a significant event in his life, which he may say some things about. In the St. Louis area, he's been active in the Native American community as a writer publishing on the national scene and as a cultural organizer locally. If any of you have attended any of the powwows in Jefferson Barracks or at Washington University, Carter Rivard was one of the moving forces that made that happen. He's currently president of the board of the American Indian Center of Mid-America, and he participates regularly in Osage gourd dancing. His poetry and prose has been widely published in magazines and anthologies. Recently, he's been published in major anthologies such as the Riverside Reader, New Worlds in Literature, and Fallen Leaves, a collection of Native American stories. He's published also several collections of his own poems. A recent one is called Ponca War Dancers, and upcoming in 93, I'm told, University of Arizona Press has accepted one of his books called An Eagle Nation, and Point Riders Press in Oklahoma will publish another collection called Cowboys and Indians. He's a wonderful poet, a real narrative poet in terms of a lot of his poems are little stories within poems. So please open your ears and your hearts and enjoy the work of Carter Rivard.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate your coming, and I'm glad I'm reading before Curtis. And I ought to, being a fussy scholar, I'm going to change a few things that Michael told you. Though I'm a gourd dancer, the Osages don't, as such, have gourd dancing. That's a Kiowa and Comanche begun warrior society sort of thing. So as an Osage, I may go and be a gourd dancer, but I'm not an Osage gourd dancer. That's news to Michael. So we got. And the other thing is that my name was given actually in 1952 rather than 51, which doesn't matter a heck of a lot, except makes me a year older and a little bit more ready for it, I guess. I'm going to start this collection called Cowboys and Indians that Point Riders Press will put out probably April or May, and it's been pretty well typeset, and we're trying to negotiate just how it's poems will overlap with those of the other volume, The Eagle Nation, which Arizona, I think, will be publishing later next year sometime. And the title volume, the title poem of the volume here, called Cowboys and Indians, I'll start with here. It's for a relative by marriage, the father of my younger sister's husband, in other words, a father-in-law of my sister, who was an old cowboy in Oklahoma. And, of course, my sister, since I have a full-blood Osage stepfather, my sister's half Osage, so she married a young cowboy guy. They spent quite a bit of time on the Mullendore Ranch and stuff like that down in Oklahoma. And they could tell you in detail just how mean old Gene Mullendore was. As for young Gene, who married an Osage woman, he was murdered by mafia for the insurance, I guess. His wife, I think, lives well. This is called Cowboys and Indians. Yes, he was a good shot and rode a horse well, herded cattle for big ranchers sometimes, rented a little place, and raised most of the family's food when he could, lived on the edges of towns, or in the smallest ones. A cheerful man would fix what broke, rent him a little house, the fences and the yard would be kept straight and friendly, yours and mine kept clear, but no doors locked, a visit always welcomed and too short, would lift your spirits. See, the movies just never show how cowboys took care of things, would doctor cows and bale the hay, help with grandchildren, have pockets full of mints or dimes to give them when he came to visit. Yes, they hugged his legs. They knew a day's work didn't keep him from driving down to see them in the evening. The movies never show a cowboy's children might marry an Indian's. His grandchildren crowd in close to see the snake eggs that he found digging fence holes that day. White, soft-shelled, translucent. His pocket knife would pierce a leathery shell, its clear liquid spill down, the small triangular head poke through, a 6-inch snakelet ooze on out. Minute forked tongue flickering, coiling, nervous and quick. Rattler or milk snake? That was a question. Maybe copperhead. The point is, nothing ever kept him from having other people firmly in mind. He liked finding such things, but what he liked most was bringing them for kids to see. Yes, they'll see the man who brought them. That's how he stays with them. No, he wasn't John Wayne or Lorne Greene. Oklahoma into Hollywood doesn't go. Still, there are other places, and where he has gone, if anybody values neighbors, they're crowding round and seeing what he's brought, and glad to have it, too. Mints, dimes, snake eggs. A good man. That part. I got one called Communing Before Supermarkets, and Frank Parman and I are talking about whether the title of the book ought to be Cowboys and Indians Communing Before Supermarkets, but it might be a little much. It's probably because we were always trying to have enough money to eat that I can taste and smell the truckloads of summer that came by and sometimes turned jouncing up the long dirt lane from U.S. 60 to our house. They saw kids swarming out in the yard, white house with a green roof and a big white two-story garage, hay barn and cow barn. Nothing around but meadows, no crops, no rows of corn or hills of watermelons. A lot of hungry kids that would be wanting what they were taking round from their truck farms or orchards. Elephantine loads of melons, sometimes the light green long ones, the striped ones, the dark green cannonballs, incredible abundance. Or old swaying trucks loaded with bushels of peaches, apples and apricots, with grapes and pears that I remember. Where had they come from? That's what I wonder now. Over in Sand Creek Valley, by the little town in the Osage Hills. The hamlet, really. They called it Okisa, where we drove once. Means halfway in Osage. There we saw a hillside full of orchards and berry bushes and the sandy bottom land, shaggy with watermelon vines where the great green melons rounded heavy and warm on the loam. It struck me staring from the car how strange that dirt does turn into their sweet, crisp red flesh and juice in the mouth. that those long vines can draw the dark earth up and make it melons. And I said to myself, how does the seed know to make a watermelon and not an apricot? Then we had brought our dimes and pennies for summer's day. We took the silver and the copper, and we turned them into two huge melons that the blonde boy went casually out into the field and pulled. Just those we wanted. He took our 30 cents, and we drove away back down to Sand Creek, and in the pebbly shallow ford we drove out in the water and killed the engine, and we took the melons from the trunk and in the shallow ripples splashed each other in the car. We washed the car, the melons. We took them out onto the bank and sat on a blanket spread across the grass and stuck a great long butcher knife into the first green melon. And it split. It was so ripe it cracked almost before the knife could cut it open. The red heart looked sugar frosted, dewy with juice, and the pieces broke to our fingers better than to knives. In the mouth, crisp and melting, fragrant, spicy nearly. As pieces of rind were scattered, the ants, reporting mountains of manna, climbed and swarmed and buried themselves in our leavings. As we stripped to shorts and underthings and waded down into the deeper, colder pool below the ford, where the springs welled slowly out from under the bouldery bank at the bend. And swimming, I thought, now the melon's turning into me, and my sisters and brothers, my mother and father and uncles and aunts, and into the ants feasting there on the melon rinds. And into the grass and the trees growing there, and into the dirt, and Sand Creek is turning. This day is turning tonight. So now when we go home, I'll remember, and it'll be turned into words. And maybe sometime it will all grow again, a long way off, a long way into the future. And that's what a few pennies and dimes can do if you have them, a few seeds, a little rain, where the creek waters rise, and the whole world turns into food for all the different beings in their times. This is called Criminals as Creators of Capital. Maybe a little different from the other one. Turning things into a little different sort of stuff. I don't know how we'd ever get along without our criminals. Think how many jobs it takes to support one criminal. First off, the jails. The architects it takes to plan them. And then the bricklayers. All the steel rod makers to reinforce the concrete and to bar the windows. The lawyers. My God. There alone is half the budget of a Roman emperor. Lawyers to prove them guilty. Lawyers to show they're innocent. Lawyers to fiddle their taxes for them, lawyers to help appeal appeals of appeals, and then the inventors, those who make the locks and those who file the keys. Bomb makers, gun makers, pawn shops, handcuff makers, a whole damn set of manufacturers, poison gas pellets, electric chairs, gallows ropes. I wonder if the guy who invented the hangman's knot obtained a patent for it. And then, of course, all the police, the FBI, the SEC, that's the Securities and Exchange Commission, the DEA, the SWAT teams, and all the special gear, gumshoes and all, the tear gas makers, shoulder holster, and billy club makers, dome lights for police cars, the gasoline for all that driving round and round the block, electric lights for desk sergeants, pensions for the widows of policemen killed in the line of duty, insurance for the cars and personnel. It isn't what they steal. It's what we do to catch them, stop them, keep them from it. They generate the law, create police, construct our locks and jails, determine where we can walk at night. I used to think the ad men were important, and executives, entrepreneurs who set the price of interest. Hell, criminals set the price of life. Where are the statues for them? Here's one poem to the unknown, unsung criminal. He, she makes the world go square. I don't think you better tell anybody I wrote that. This is called The Secret Verbs. It's another kind of criminal. The Secret Verbs. 1989, I had a visiting professorship at the University of Oklahoma. And 1989 was the centennial year for Oklahoma. It's the image you always see, the land run. You come in there, and I guess you wonder maybe sometimes where that land came from, as it were, that everybody ran into. So I thought I'd tell you. This is called the secret verbs. It was a verb that did it. They're hidden right in plain sight. Take unassigned lands, for instance. What's the verb? To unassign. A powerful verb. In 1889, it grabbed almost 2 million acres of Indian land, where Oklahoma City squats. And all those other towns, wheat farms and ranches, oil wells and politicians. Yes, I know, grammatically speaking, how squat infects its many subjects. Now, why call these lands unassigned? Well, after the Civil War, the Creeks and Seminoles were forced to concede this land for settlement by freed slaves. They were the slaves of the civilized tribes, you see. So what the participle unassigned means is this: we unassign these lands to blacks or Indians. We now assign them to Americans so long as they are white. That's all the grammar lesson for today. But for tomorrow, why not look around at other participles and adjectives which have deleted agents and unspoken objects and which are negative? You see how powerful they are and how they hide their power and how, like red-striped sheets, they cover both the subjects and the objects of their actions. Just for instance, the verbs discover and covert, or disinform, that's for disinformation, it was invented for the Cold War, or un-American, or unused land. How we unuse our language is maybe worth a thought in a centennial year. And every year is centennial for something, isn't it? This is called Summer 1983, and it's a story that comes just about the way my Ponca cousins tell it. My Uncle Woody, on the Scotch-Irish side, married a Ponca Indian woman. Poncas and Osages are neighbors down in Oklahoma. They got shoved down there from Nebraska, and we got shoved down there from Missouri. We like it there, okay. Now, we resisted a little bit, but not too much, I guess. This is called Summer 1983. My Ponca cousins go up every summer to the Sundance up at Rosebud. They've been going to the one that Leonard Crowdog runs up there. And they've been going since about 71, 69, along in there. So this is the story. Going up to the Sundance at Rosebud there in Nebraska, they stopped, my Ponca cousins from Oklahoma. It was out there by some kind of ruins on the August Prairie. Some kind of fort it may have been. They stopped to eat a little, get out and stretch their legs. The van had got too little for the kids and all. And they were walking, not paying much attention. And they heard the singing. And Serena said, "Listen, that's a Ponca song. Hear it? Where's it coming from?" And they listened, and Mike said, "Sounds like it's over inside those walls or whatever they may be there." So they walked through the dry, short grass towards the raised earth walls and up on them and looked inside the wide compound, and there was not a soul in sight. "That was a victory song," Mike said. "It was," Serena said. "When they told me later, we looked it up, and we found it was where the Cheyennes and some of their allies had chased troops inside a fort and taunted them. It was after Sand Creek. That time the news got out of what had been done at Sand Creek to Black Kettle and his Cheyenne people there, under the big American flag, a sign of peace. George Bent, whose son was captured as a Confederate soldier here in Missouri, and whose son, being half Cheyenne, was taken back by him after they sort of ransomed him away, and they took him out to the Sand Creek area, and he got there in time to watch the massacre. So it says, George Bent has told about that story in his letters out there about Sand Creek, and these Cheyenne soldiers had come, the Cheyenne warriors, after that massacre and dealt with it. "I guess," Mike said, "there must have been some ponkas joined the Cheyennes and fought the soldiers there." "We recognize the song," Serena said. "It's one that we still sing." Okay. Now, that's a little tricky. That's just a funny thing that happens to my cousins sometimes. And there are a lot of Indian stories like that that don't make sense, but they do make a lot of sense, I guess, if you don't mind contradicting yourself. This is a poem called It's Hell Down There. There's a lot of oil in Oklahoma, but it takes a little digging. And I did go over to England on a Rhodes scholarship, and that Cecil Rhodes money comes out of South Africa. You probably know about that. But that's something that's in this poem, along with the fact that to get at the really deep stuff, natural gas or oil, you have to go down and do a lot of things that you don't need to do or don't have to bother with when you're drilling at 2,000-4,000 feet. You get down to this 15,000-16,000 feet, and it's really tough. So this is called It's Hell Down There. "It's hell down there, and it's looking at you," says the driller. He means that natural gas, 5-6 miles below his rig, where pressure shatters the quartzite grains so they can't flow, and his frack master has to shoot down hard grains of sintered bauxite, propping open cracks for gas and water to sizzle up and join us here. And red-hot sulfur, not to mention hydrogen sulfide, sulfur dioxide, eats hell out of the pipes. It is hell, the driller says, looking at you. And he spits right in its eye. Or, well, he has his pumping trucks out-pressure it with water, twiddling those dials so that hell is kept down screeching under earth. Just sends up a hiss of dinosaur breath for earthly flames. Money to burn. That's what my buddy, who's become a wildcat oil man, has. He's hit it big, only got back from Oxford with his law degree 6 years ago. These decontrolling years made for Rhodes Scholar brains. He drives a BMW, does hang gliding in his last big strike in the Anadarko Basin. Ought to go $9 million this year. Next year, who knows? Diamonds. That's what Cecil Rhodes went down to get rich on. But what he really coined it from was water pumps the other diamond miners couldn't get down without. They paid in diamonds, or he took their mines. And then he drove that diamond-bitted drill into imperial politics. Hell is waiting in South Africa now. It's looking at the men on top. The people down there want to turn that hell to paradise. Power to the people, we say, and we turn on the natural gas to perk our breakfast coffee. On our hands, gold wedding bands and diamonds sparkle like forever. I got one. I got one here called "Indians Demand Equal Time with God." And the subtitle is "Angry Demonstrators at the Funeral." "Hey, wait a minute, you guys that climb God like a ladder up to Rome, Zion, then Paris, London, Moscow, and Washington, D.C. You trying to tell us Osages that he died in Nietzsche's lap, is embalmed in Lenin's tomb, got shrunk on Sigmund's couch, that all his priests turned poets, then defected to Mad Avenue and worshiped the brazen-faced Ms. Liberty? Listen, you dirty majoritarians, kicking our ladder away, now you've got up. You ought to be advised that even old Coyote comes back to life, no matter what direction or how far your ladder falls. You think because he sees right through you that he just isn't looking? You've been putting the wrong vowels into that four-letter word. We're not looking just for careers, fame, money. We want to stay alive. Hearts die the minute things aren't life or death. And when things die, beliefs go radioactive and can kill with half-lives. But we're used to this. Our stories have often killed off God. Their chromosomes play Job among the potsherds of our pueblos all the time. We won't let you kill him even now before we're ready. Until then, quit stepping on our fingers, damn it. They fit this ladder well enough. Look out, Big Dipper, here we come. I was thinking that there are some creatures it's very hard to identify with. I don't know whether people in Missouri, unless you really get outside, know what chiggers are. You do, yeah. You pick blackberries too, huh? And it's an African word. It's a very nice one. So this is about chiggers, and as I say, they're not easy to identify with, and I don't want any chiggers to get too friendly with me if they hear this. I thought they were heading for the same sort of area that we were, and took a little different way, hitchhiking. But this is called chiggers. We grew up crossing the blue-stemmed meadows full of flowers in May, when butterflies were coming out to meet the flowers at last as equals, like equations that have found their Einstein and can sip the nectar of hyperspace at will. And when also were hatching out the tiny scarlet chiggers, holding up their hooks for rides toward heaven, not on brilliant wings, but under the skin, and drinking the blood of huge paradisal monsters like us. Well, noblesse oblige. Like angels, we took them into eternity as far as they were going, helping them believe in providence. Maybe to angels, when they come down to snuff wildflowers of gratitude or skunks of treachery, time is only a chigger bite they carry back to heaven. Or maybe souls can't change until they've tapped into red lasers pulsing under the bright skin of stars. Maybe every infinitesimal 11-dimension string wriggles into a downy angelic wing and flies to places it does not see, like scarlet chiggers on a red-winged blackbird's epaulette, or like the blackbird's feet not grasping within the wire it's on the good news from Jerusalem or a quasar at this universe's edge. To lie down in green pastures and get up as providence, that is, with chiggers, may not be a sign of misspent youth, but I wonder who's itching with these words within that space and time. Thought I would throw that in. Now, I've got a couple or three things here that are what they call, in some ways, riddles. The old English people used to write them, and I thought it was a good idea to try to deal with the Anglo-Saxon tribe now and then. And I teach that stuff here and there. The old English riddles are liturgy poems. They don't have to rhyme, which is one advantage. They have to alliterate. They fall into half lines, and you have to have an alliterative word in this line that goes with an alliterative word in that, sometimes two over here and one over here. So this one first is called a birch canoe. In the riddle, the object or the being speaks to you. The object or the being speaks to you as itself, and one of the things that happens is the kind of magic of the world comes through in these things. Now, birch canoes were built, of course, out of the bark, cut off the white birch tree, and sewn together. And I'm imagining in here that they're sewn together with the sinews taken from deer legs. I know, in fact, that a lot of the time tree roots, very fine tree roots and other things were used, but for the purposes of this riddle, I thought I would take the deer and get them in here. It was a birch canoe. It's very short. You don't have to worry much about it. It's a long introduction. Dark men bent my body down, cutting into me, carved my paleness. Sewing its pieces pierced me with sinews from Lightfoot deer who leaped this stream. Now in my ghost's skin they glide over clouds at home here in the fishes. Fallen heaven. Whether you know that or not. And I was going to try the Swan Song, but that's an actual translation of an old English one, but it's be a little harder to find right here in this second volume. So I'm going to read this other one, Riddle. It's for an Eagle fan. About in September of 1990, I was given Eagle feathers, and they were beaded into a fan that I carry when I am at the dances. And these feathers are very important to the Indians. They, Evelyn Volker down at the center says they're telephoned to God, which usually been busy, but they do get there, I think. And so I was much humbled by this and very pleased about it, and I got a friend to bead them into a fan, these nine feathers, and he asked me what colors, and I said I liked the light blue and the dark blue, and then as a gourd dancer I wear a blanket for the dance that is in two halves, a scarlet and a kind of a midnight blue color. It's the kind of the day and the night, with a stripe down the middle, like the noonday stripe. So I imagined in the beadwork thing, the needle, the silver needle going through, you take a shaped stick and you wrap it, glue in white buckskin, and then of course you sew these beads to this in their patterns, and it's a very intricate sort of a thing. So I thought of the eagle spiraling. I'm going the wrong way, it should be going clockwise, as we dance that way. I thought of the eagle spiraling in the sky. I thought of the dancers going around the drum, and I thought, of course, of the beadworking needle going around and producing this pattern. Turquoise blue background, like the sky, and then the colors of the other things in here. So this is a riddle here. This is for Bob and Evelyn Volker, and for Dale and Arlene Bessie. Dale did the beadwork thing for me, and for the St. Louis gourd dancers. I strung dazzling thrones of thunder beings on a spiraling thread of spinning flight, beading dawn's blood and blue of noon to the gold and dark of day's leaving, circling with sun the soaring heaven over turquoise eyes of earth below, the silver veins, the sable fur. I heard human relatives hunting beneath, calling me down, crying their need that I bring them closer to Wakanda's ways. And I turned from heaven to help them then. When the bullet came, it caught my heart. The hunter's hands gave earth its blood, loosened light beings, and let us float toward the sacred center of song in the drum, but fixed us first firm in tree heart, that green light dancers gave to men's knives, ash heart in hiding, where a deer's heart had beat. And a one-eyed serpent with silver straight head strung tiny rattles around white softness in beaded harmonies of blue and red. Now I move lightly in a man's left hand, above dancing feet, follow the sun around old songs, soaring toward heaven on human breath, and I help them rise. Yeah. I've got a poem called That Lightning is Hard to Climb. I expect Catalpa trees. You probably are on pretty good terms with some of them, although you may just know them casually in passing. They're very nice trees. They've got these great, huge, heart-shaped leaves, and then they're the ones that have these long pods or beams that hang down. And as kids, we used to climb the ones that were out in our front yard, have a good time with them. And then I telephoned home one time and heard that the lightning had got one of them, really come down and let it have it. So I wrote this poem, which sort of memory of the things back in there. Struck down? Good Lord, we'd always be climbing that tall catalpa tree. Its leaves were money. Its long pods, cigars. And all of May, we swung and taunted in high danger and falling blossoms among those great heart-shaped leaves where a loud beating of raindrops made us, on almost breaking limbs after a taste of purple-streaked blossoms with their gold stamens, feel sheltered and vulnerable, seeing how blue sky looked among sun-lucent leaves as we hung waiting until bright lines of rain came sweeping down over us from the leafy hills across our blue-stemmed meadow and made us see how the scissortails had placed their nest beneath a tent of tilting leaves that the wind kept parting above the nestlings, and how that swaying giant held them in its arms as the flashing giant glanced in flooding silver down on them and on their long-tailed mother sitting patient and streaming off half-opened wings the dancing spatter. And when it had gone, there was all the twinkle and diamond flashing in the meadow, the ring and whistle of robin, of orioles, and red-winged blackbirds, sprinkling again the sunburst tree in bloom from whose tip the scissortails, towering and interweaving challenges, could veer and dip and zoom up and up, shrieking, treep, tree-ee-ee, building a musical tree to sing from, while below for us the trunk rose solid from the twilight lawn, safe base for wood-tag runners, as the dark filled up with lightning bugs, stars, and cries of the children, running among the trees while grown-ups watched from the gloominess porch, talking of old and happy far-off things and laughter long ago. So now, the one more storm has set blossoms of fire exploding. Now the lightning U-Haul has come down and transported our halfway house, our swaying path to the sky, whose fall seems to have saved our house, and it's gone, and only some green shoots with their heart-shaped leaves now mantle where it stood. I'm of course thinking of the sweet chariot and the Elijah stuff, because as you know, when he went, he left the mantle there for Elisha. So it's not quite a kosher poem, but I do think of the passing on there of things. Okay, now I've got one more thing, and this is called Given, and it's I don't know, I may say it's for the children there. I'll just read this, and I think that will be all we can stand for now. Given this world to grow into, I know they'll repossess it shortly, along with what's left of me. But rumpled into this little pocket of time, I wish there were a little more of me to sing the mortgage payments. How it really dawns on me this morning, as the light has brimmed and spills all rosy into the east, with robins paying their rent in song, and with the downy woodpecker's telephone pole tattoo explaining the nod of daffodils and endless pin oaks, maples, ash, and sycamore, and locust, sweet gum, dogwood, and redbud bowing into the April wind stream. Over us, blind and flightless creatures, blundering, noisy, and slow as brachiosaurs, or squeaking and rumbling like humpback whales beneath the birds, where they are singing that the springing wealth of new leaves and light and flowers has made it practical to consummate the mystery of nesting, if within earshot the right females would return the secret signs that they will partner them. We see, we learn to see and hear and feel the way those leaves come out of buds, all tight with liquid virtue, rising from earth-blind roots into bright air to fan their soft translucent green as they ask the light into their bowers of sugars, starches, lignans, as we see in green and hear in song how light becomes a tree and holds the singers in its branches where curving and blue as sky, small eggs will open and blind reptilian robins fledge and find how to sing the light back into dawn, their arias and duets soaring above star songs of tree frogs in the summer dark. Just as into translucent salmon sunrise the stars dissolve, white clouds set sail across the blue dazzle above us, walking on our stony earth, where clopping and grating we look up into those heavens of green and blue and white, where the trees, without moving, are given the earth and the sun and the stars. And those who have wings now are singing. And those who have climbed from sea to earth and air and lived now on dew and the trees' plenty are singing where the moon brings back a softer light from the sun, where the stars bring us the great glittering darkness that has no end.